It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The first and perhaps most important public measure in establishing Rivian Automotive at the former Mitsubishi plant passed last night. The Normal Town Council voted unanimously on a performance-based economic incentive package that could result in a $1 million outright grant once all of the objectives are met, along with property tax abatements. There has been skepticism about the company expressed on social media and at the council meeting, much of it driven by a lack of information online. In the studio to shed some light on the company and to talk more about Rivian Automotive, the former Mitsubishi plant it plans to buy, and its future plans in central Illinois and in the car industry is founder and CEO RJ Scaringe. Thanks for making time to be on Sound Ideas today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
What's your reaction to last night's vote?
Well, I think the council had an opportunity to really understand what our strategy is, understand more about our business, and also recognize the amount of diligence and the efforts of the economic development team here to fully understand our business and the work that went into really mapping that out.
Where is that plan, that economic incentive plan, maybe weakest for you, and where is it strongest for you?
So I think for us, one of the most important aspects of this was making sure that we had a commitment from the community and understanding that, you know, beyond the incentive plan, that the community actually wanted this to go forward. And I think last night we saw that from the commission, certainly in all of our meetings over the last several months, we've really seen that. And we've been really enthused by the amount of energy that this community has.
At this time next year, to secure the tax abatement, Rivian must invest $500,000 into the plant. By the end of 2018, Rivian must prove a $10 million investment and have 35 employees. Tell me about what happens in those 2 years. How does the company sort of grow into that?
Sure. So in parallel to all the efforts going into readying the plant to launch the vehicle, there's also the vehicle development efforts. So we've got a vehicle development team that's based in Michigan that's working hard, long hours, long days, to continually advance and progress the vehicle. Right now, we're in our beta development phase, which precedes the pre-production and production phase. We've successfully completed the alpha testing phase, as I mentioned last night at the meeting. Some of the folks within the team have had a chance to drive and ride in the vehicle, and I think they've been really impressed by both the status of the vehicle, but also just by the nature of the vehicle and its level of performance and its level of utility and really how the way it drives. But at the plant side, there's a whole host of planning activities that are going to occur over the next year. So mapping out how this vehicle goes into the plant, what changes need to be made to the facility, what portions of the facility we're able to reuse, what portions of the facility we need to replace. And over the course of the next 2 years, we'll be ramping up with implementing those plans, so replacing equipment, improving certain aspects of the facility. And as was mentioned last night, the numbers that we've committed to, we look at those as sort of the floor, the low end. We actually have more aggressive internal plans to invest more heavily in the facility and to move as quickly as possible and to also look at things beyond just the production activities.
So go ahead.
This ties into some of the testing activities that I referred to last night, as well as some of the supplier involvement where we want to have some of our key suppliers come in and actually operate in the facility with us.
So is this the right plant at the right time for Rivian?
So we've been for the past really 2 years looking at how and where to set up our production footprint. And you can imagine the discussions range from looking at setting up something very small that we would then sort of within year two, year three outgrow, to obviously something like this where it has a great foundation for us to grow from. Ultimately, after going through that really in-depth analysis, we've decided to make the investment in a facility that has the foundation for us to scale significantly over the coming decade. So this not only will house our first product, but a range of products within our planned portfolio. And with that said, the facility has a bunch of additional ancillary benefits, other things we can bring in plant. As I mentioned, some of the supplier activity can come in plant. Some of the other aspects of the vehicle that we're planning to build on the outside or in other facilities, we can pull in. An example of that would be our battery module. So we're purchasing cells from a supplier.
And I guess we should state we haven't talked much about the car yet, and we will in a moment, but this is an electric drive vehicle.
This is an electric vehicle. Thank you. And so the batteries which drive the motors in the vehicle, those are assembled into modules, and those modules are assembled into the pack. The module and pack assembly is actually going to be done in this facility as well. So that's going to be a new addition to what's there today.
You originally toured the plant to look at some of the sophisticated equipment that's still there. When did you say, you know, maybe the equipment should stay and Rivian should move to Normal?
Yeah, so I mentioned this last night. When we originally were looking at the facility and looking at the what was there, we came out as part of looking at this from an auction point of view. So we were looking at various portions of the plant that we were looking to buy and move into another facility in another location. And we've, as I said, we've been looking at other facilities and other locations, and some of those we were more advanced on at the time. Ultimately, as we started to understand the local community, understand this facility, it became very clear that there was a real opportunity for us to not just buy some of the equipment, but actually to purchase the entire facility. And I mentioned this last night, but it's worth noting again here. The community that surrounds this facility is really something special. If you look at other plants within the Midwest region and areas that have been affected by either plants shutting down or manufacturing moving out of the area, you don't have this level of energy and you don't have this level of progressive thinking. And the town that surrounds this facility is just phenomenal. Our team saw that. We had our board and our shareholders came out for the facility visits. And one of our board members, who's a very strong manufacturing background, one of the things he focused on first before we even went to the plant is he spent a lot of time looking at the area. So he said, I want to go sort of drive around town. I want to spend some time in restaurants. I want to sort of get a feel for the area, because that has to do with how we're going to recruit. It has to do with sort of the attitude around the plant. And before he even saw the facility, he said, boy, I have a really good feeling about this place. So we're excited to be joining this community. We want to participate and make this this growth in our activities within the plant something that the community is proud of.
Jill Blair on Facebook, we asked for some questions on Facebook, and Jill Blair posted, how do you plan to build relationships in the community and be a good corporate citizen?
And that's a great question, and it's something that we're putting together a robust plan that has sort of ways for us to interact across a variety of different measures, or a variety of different areas, I should say. So there's certainly opportunities for us to interact on an academic front. So there's a strong both 2-year and 4-year school program right in this area. There's ways for us to interact with some of the professional communities. So we've got the sort of emergency response community. We've got a number of folks that can use the large parking facilities for various activities. And we're looking at how can we connect with some of the entrepreneurs in this community and leverage some of the assets that we have, both in terms of workspace as well as some of the making space. So there's a movement within the entrepreneurial community around making things. It's called the Makers Movement. We'd like to leverage this facility to be part of that movement.
Is there anything specific that your advanced person that came in and spent some time in the community saw that he pointed out to you that about the community, something that he really liked?
Yeah, so we've had a team of people that have been spending time here understanding the community, and certainly one of the things we saw was this this sense of forward thinking and this sense of sort of desire for progress, desire for growth. And we really are excited about how can we leverage this facility and also leverage a lot of the things we're working on, whether it's on technical aspects of the vehicle development or whether it's on leveraging some of the production or fabrication capabilities of the plant.
What about workforce? Jerry Harcharek posted a question on our Facebook page about the UAW. Will the UAW be part of Rivian's workforce?
It's a great question. So at this point and where we are from a timing point of view, we haven't laid out or finalized our workforce strategy. Certainly a big component of us looking at this facility was recognizing the very strong workforce that exists here. And this is a workforce that was very recently employed at this facility. So a lot of the efforts we're putting in place, as I said, is to try to populate the plant with activity quicker than what we've even committed to the community here, so that we can preserve a lot of this active workforce and keep them in the plant, keep them in the area.
That's RJ Scaringe, founder and CEO of Rivian Automotive, planning to buy the Mitsubishi plant in Normal. When you were named a champion of change by the Obama White House, WhiteHouse.gov posted that Rivian is reinventing the way cars are developed, manufactured, and distributed. Can you give me an example of how Rivian is doing development planning to do manufacturing and distribution differently.
Sure.
How is Rivian different than other car manufacturers?
So as we look at the automobile industry, since the very early days, the business model has been largely the same. One would buy an asset, and they would personally use that asset, or their household would use that asset. And that model has not changed since the very, very beginning. And when we look at the economics around that type of a customer relationship, we've become sort of numb to it, but it's actually quite bad. This is an asset that sits still, 97, 96% of the time. It depreciates very rapidly. So we're talking about 60 to 65% of the value of that asset's lost over a five-year period. And it takes a surprising amount of capital to keep that asset functional. So between fueling, service, cleaning, storage, there's a lot of costs that go into keeping that asset functional so you can use it on those rare occasions, the 3% of the time. So with that said, it's certainly created a fertile ground for new types of mobility to emerge. And this is precisely what's driven the growth around various types of ride sharing, which, Uber, Lyft, these are examples of that. It's also started the growth around various types of car sharing. So whether that's a subscription service or a fleet sharing service or a peer-to-peer sharing service. But what I often joke is, as I say, this is like 1992 in the internet days. We are at the very, very beginning of a major transformation in
Or 1902 in the automotive industry.
Sure, exactly. So we're at the very beginning of a major shift in how we look at the customer model with regards to the vehicle. So as we've designed Rivian and as I've set up the company, we've gone through several iterations, and we talked about some of these last night, where our products evolved, but also our organizational and our business strategy has evolved. But our focus is designing the company for this transition. So our launch products are launching right into this transition. So it's a world in which traditional ownership will still be the primary path to access a vehicle. But these various forms of mobility access, mobility sharing, subscription will be starting to grow more. And those new ways to relate and use the vehicle require a different asset. The asset actually has to change in fairly significant ways.
How much of this is generational? In my conversations with people my age, I'm 54, they've said, I want to own my own car.
So I think, some of it's generational, but I think it's also... it has a lot to do with sort of one's view of their vehicle. And, we talked a little bit before we hopped on here today. And, you, for example, have gone from owning two cars down to one car. And there's a surprising trend throughout the country across demographics where people are sort of unhappy with the idea of buying an asset, watching it depreciate, and sort of going through this sort of five-year cycle of buying something, having it lose value, and having to go through
that. It just feels like in fact, you keep calling it an asset. I might call it a liability.
Yeah, perfect. Exactly.
So, I feel like with car ownership, you're just throwing money into a black hole.
Sure, exactly. So as we relate this back to our organizational structure and our strategic plan, we've designed our entire work stream around this. So from the very first sketch through the customer using the vehicle, we're rethinking how we structure the organization. And a lot of this comes into system design, where we have functions that normally don't connect or talk to one another. We're making sure they integrate. So at a vehicle level, this is making sure the chassis team is working with the powertrain team, is working with the body structures team, is working with the interior team. And a lot of those things, frankly, are easier when you have a smaller organization. You can sort of connect the organization in new ways. But then we're taking those vehicle-centric activities and we're connecting them with all the downstream activities. So what does the customer relationship look like? What happens when the vehicle is no longer something that you own personally, but rather something that you subscribe to that's provided as a service? And when we start to think about the vehicle implications, there's some significant changes. So let me just give a very simple example. So if I were to offer to you a ride to go from your office today back home, mm-hmm. And they gave you the choice of a Mercedes S-Class that smelled or a pristine, perfectly clean, let's say, Toyota Corolla. Well, of course, the S-Class is a much more expensive vehicle, and from a traditional ownership point of view, you'd prefer to have that. From the point of view of having a ride home, you'd prefer to sit in the asset that doesn't smell.
It depends on how bad the S-Class car actually smelled, but sure. Yes, I see what you're saying.
So but all of a sudden, from a vehicle design point of view, you start to really think about things like odor control. You start to think about things like cleanability, maintainability. And as
the last car we had to rent was kind of a mess. There were coffee stains on it.
For sure.
Not supposed to be a smoking car. It obviously smelled like cigarettes. So.
For sure. So for us, as our product plan unfolds, our first product is something that does exist in an ownership-centric world. So you can buy it, you can use it 3% of the time, but we've also provided mechanisms whereby you can share it and you can access it. So our follow-on products really take the next step, and these are products that are designed purely for mobility as a service. And the nature of these products are going to be complementary with the first set of products in the sense that you may own one of our launch products. Is sort of a weekend vehicle, something you really engage with. It's fun to drive. It's highly efficient. It's got a ton of utility. But then, you know, for your weekday mobility needs, you use a Rivian mobility service.
And is that an autonomous service at some point in the future?
Oh, for sure. And this is beyond our activities, as I think you well recognize. There's a part of this major transformation is a shift not only in the customer model, but also in the vehicle operational model. So today, you know, 100% of the miles on the road are human-operated miles. Of course, there's driver assist technologies that are out, but these are, you know, really just assist technologies. Over the course of the next several decades, we're going to see the vehicle fleet shift from one of human operation to one of machine operation. And with that transition, the utilization of these assets will go from 3% to 30, 40, 50, 60%. And for me, the really exciting part about that is what it can do to the economics of mobility. So if you imagine an asset,
fewer cars being used more, too.
Fewer cars being used more, and the cost per mile can drop significantly. We're not talking by 10%. We're talking by 5 to 10x.
And you're talking about the economics of this. I'm sorry I interrupted.
No. So yeah. The economics of your own mobility will go from, let's say, $1 a mile, 90 cents a mile, to 15, 20 cents a mile.
And it sounds more sustainable then, too.
Of course. One of the neat things about utilizing an asset more is you can rationalize spending more on the asset. So you can rationalize focusing on operating costs, which a main driver is efficiency. So it really promotes electrifying the vehicle, where your operating costs, which become a major driver of the cost structure as opposed to the depreciation cost, start to dominate the overall cost model.
So can you walk me through this a little bit? Let's say we're 15 years into the future. I have a phone. And I have a subscription to Rivian. Mm-hmm. I call for a car. It comes to me without a driver, and then it takes me to where I want to go. And then when I'm not using it, it's serving someone else.
Exactly. And there's a lot of big players working on this within the supply chain. There are people working on the automotive, the autonomous technology. Also within some of the major tech companies that are working. You know, we see a lot of activity working around autonomous technologies. And as we look at this, the part that we feel really needs to change as well is the vehicle asset itself. So the design of the vehicle, the trade-offs that are made between bill of materials cost and service cost and cleaning cost, the sort of way we solve those trade-offs has to shift, and in some cases shift quite dramatically.
Did you look, when you were looking at Bloomington Normal, did you look at the surrounding transportation infrastructure and say, this might be a pretty good proving ground for our product?
Oh, for sure. With Illinois State being integrated right into the community, a really sort of young, active, vibrant community that's many of the community does not have vehicles full time and they need other ways to access mobility. There's some really interesting things that we can learn.
And does this work in tandem with transit, do you think?
Sure. So, I mean, the concepts we're talking about here, are part of a macro global discussion around how the makeup and design of our cities starts to change as we see vehicles go from traditional ownership, very low levels of utilization, to shared access. And of course, the parking needs of cities change, the roadway needs start to shift. So this is going to be a pretty significant, as I said, transformation over the next several decades.
We might see a Rivian on the road at some point in the future in Bloomington Normal as it's being tested, or is that going to happen somewhere else, do you think?
For sure. In fact, we had some prototype vehicles out at the plant a few weeks ago, and we were a bit concerned somebody might capture a few photographs.
I wish I'd gone by.
Yeah, luckily we didn't let you know beforehand.
Founder and CEO of Rivian Automotive, RJ Scaringe, is in the studio. He spoke with the Normal Town Council last night. The council voted unanimously to approve an economic incentive package, moving Rivian closer to purchasing the former Mitsubishi plant. Let's talk about the decision to play it so close to the vest, stealth mode, as you call it. There are no images. You actually turned off the website just before this deal was announced. Twitter is dormant. I think GLT tweeted more about Rivian last night than and put more information in social media than is available online.
Sure.
Why go that route?
Yeah, and you guys tweeted more last night than we have in the last 5 years. I also said more over the last 24 hours than we've said in the last 5 years. It really, and we went through some of the background last night, some of the history, but you know, I started Rivian in a really tough economic time. So this was mid-2009. This was the middle of Chrysler and GM's bankruptcy. This was really at the tail end, or sorry, I should say post a lot of the clean tech movement and the investment that went into high capex businesses in the energy and clean technology sector. So it was a very tough fundraising environment. And in those early years, we had to go through some tough processes just to raise a very small amount of capital. And at the end of 2011, we made a pretty significant pivot that pivoted away from the product that we'd talked about in those early years and really had us focus on raising the hundreds of millions of dollars that's necessary to launch this business. And to make a long story short, starting in 2012, we put together a very strong set of investors that have committed to and provided the hundreds of millions of dollars necessary, but it brought us down a path in which there were a lot of unknowns in those in the 2012-2013 timeframe around the direction of the business, around the product strategy. And really, because of, frankly, some of the things we talked too much about in the early days, we made the decision to go deep into stealth mode and to avoid the distraction of you know, committing to things and making statements that were highly likely to change. And over the course of the last year and a half, in April of 2015, we locked in and secured the final sort of stage of all of our production financing to take us through profitability. And subsequent to that, we've been ramping up our efforts, but we've been doing that still in stealth with the intent of when we started to talk, not having any changes to direction, being able to talk and speak with confidence. And of course, this plant purchase is the first piece of us emerging from stealth. And going forward, we'll be taking a more transparent approach. We certainly want the community and broader North American and global audience to see and see what we're doing and, of course, become excited about what we're doing.
Hindsight is 2020, but maybe if you'd put out some of your own information, you wouldn't have been you could have had maybe the top spot in a Google search instead of maybe some of the information that was out there. Have you looked back and said, well, maybe we should have communicated or had a different communication strategy?
Sure. And Mike, and I could list a very long list of mistakes that we would have done differently in hindsight, but this is certainly one of them. I think for the local community here, there's a lot of concerns going into yesterday's meeting, not knowing the history of the company, not knowing how well we are financed, not knowing the history and the story that we've gone through to put together our team, our investor base, and some of that it would have been better if we'd had a clear message on the front end. Saying that, I think some of their mistakes, you know, we shut down the website with the intent of setting up a clean slate. We knew that we were going to have new people looking at the company. We wanted to sort of reset how they viewed us. So certainly, hindsight, we would have done a few of those things differently.
And can you tell us what the car looks like? Is it more like a Infiniti sports car, or is it more like a Honda Element? Or is it something in between?
Well, really neither. So the vehicle... The launch vehicles, there's a portfolio of related vehicles that come out we'll be launching the production in 19 and sales will be going in early 2020. It is a large format vehicle, so it's not a small vehicle. This is something that's designed to really enable active lifestyles. So if you're into hiking, you're into biking.
I want to go bar hop with 8 friends.
Yeah, you want to go bar hopping, because of course you have to drive safe.
Exactly.
But if you're a Home Depot weekend warrior, this is a really ideal vehicle for you. And there's a couple of different variants off of that really defy traditional segmentation. So it has a level of utility, a level of performance, and a level of efficiency that are very unique for a vehicle of this size. And without sort of trying to draw it into a specific segment, when we reveal the vehicle, I think it'll become clear why we're purposely not saying what segment one might bin it into.
And the reveal date? I know the production, we might see a car in 2019, right?
Oh, well, you'll be seeing a car well before 2019. We haven't set the reveal date or the reveal location.
They might be available in 2019, though. Isn't that what you said last night?
Yep.
But we'd see one earlier.
We'd see one earlier.
When do you think we might see what that looks like?
So we're at this point, we're putting together our reveal plans. We want to do something where it provides the appropriate venue for people to see the vehicle, experience the vehicle, and not have a lot of distractions. But at the same time, is has the level of excitement necessary. So we're looking at something in the next 12 months. We'd like to integrate that with some of the aspects of the plant and starting to show some of the activity there. But we'll certainly you'll certainly be hearing more from us.
All right. Lots more to talk to. I hope you'll come back as you continue to, you know, migrate between Livonia, Michigan and Bloomington Normal. We'd love to have you in the studio as this project moves forward. Founder and CEO of Rivian Automotive, RJ Scaringe, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thank you.
Rivian Automotive is planning to buy the 508-acre, 2.1 million square foot Mitsubishi plant in Normal. Besides the town of Normal, other taxing bodies have to agree to the incentive package and property tax abatements. The Heartland Community College Board votes on the plan tonight. It's Sound Ideas on GLT.